Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now and on video, of course, on our YouTube channel, hit that like, subscribe button if you want, is Paul Hill, full-time equity analyst, full-time investor. He's full on, full in, full on right now. He's the only guy I put a shirt on for. That's you know, respectful of him, I am. And check him out. If you want to learn anything about the fundamentals of investing, Paul's your man. And but you may need to start quite simple, Paul, because you get quite technical and then you've been doing it for years, I know, but you can break it down very well. And you've helped me a lot to look at you know, the fundamentals of stocks. But
well, I'm very honoured, Justin, particularly with that nice blue shirt, crisply ironed. So you do look very smart.
I've got shorts on. I'm ready for holiday. I've got shorts on below. I'm going on holiday, hopefully, unless I change the rules again before this going out. And I'm hoping I'm going abroad on holiday, so I've got my shorts on ready.
But you do lose a bit of credibility with those things sticking out your ears, but they're like cotton wool.
Well, do you know what? I worked in radio for years, and my wife said, "Do you want some, you know, Apple AirPods?" And normally my normal set of headphones about £50. These are like £300. That's like Apple, the pricing power of Apple, you know? But people started buying them. And they are good. They're very good. And I would never spend that on myself. It was a Christmas present like 2 years ago, I think. But that's like Apple will charge, and that's like the brand name, you know, going back to investing. They can charge like £60 for a plug, and people pay it. It's crazy,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, you know? You're right. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, because as you know, we've basically started this Voice of Wall Street series, speaking to a lot of fund managers out in the States. And I'm actually talking to one tomorrow, who's another frontliner from CNBC, Michael Farr of Farr Miller and Washington, who's on the halftime report with Scott Wapner all the time.
Yes, good
anyway, but it's, well, but the point is actually, it's amazing how I've interviewed four people now. It's amazing what the common thread is. And Apple is always up there simply because it's got such a strong ecosystem. I mean, I used to always sort of like view it as really a sort of like a hardware mobile phone type of consumer electronics stock, but really it's a platform, and it just shows you the pricing power, the loyalty of the customers, and that's what you need. And the reason why you and I raise it is that's what we're looking for, is smaller stocks in the sort of micro, small cap, mid cap, etc., which have got pricing power. And we've talked a lot about, you know, inflation and supply chain difficulties. If you haven't got pricing power, you're absolutely hammered. And I think Apple has got all that and more.
But also, just recently, I mean, I've been using their cloud for a while, and Google Drive for a while, and it backs up all your videos and your photographs and all that stuff. And I've been paying, I think it's like $250 a month for something like 200 gig, you know, and I got the limit. I thought, what do? Do I spend hours just going through looking at videos and things I don't want, or do I just pay £6 a month to get 2 terabytes, 10 times as much, which I'll never run out of, hopefully. Maybe I will. Who knows? And I thought, in the end, I just went for it. So that's like almost more than double their money overnight. If everyone does that, it's amazing, because no one wants to go through millions of videos. It's very clever, and Google's the same. I probably got the same stuff on Google Drive as I have on Apple, but I don't want to go through them all. It's too much hassle. Life's too short for that. So just pay it up, and you get a couple of quid, and that's what. But that a couple of quid on lots of people, millions of people, you know, adds up. So, yeah, it's very impressive.
You're Mr. Moneybags, aren't you? So if you're on holiday to the Republic, you're buying £300 AirPods and you're doing all this
I thought I was doing well until end of Q1 this year. It's been, I think the small cap, micro cap sphere in the UK is in a bear market. I mean, I was looking at some of the you know, performers there. Unbelievable how many stocks are down some more than 20, 30, 40, 50%, something even more than that. And I saw someone punching out a chart from talking about the NASDAQ and the S&P. And they said the NASDAQ, pretty much ignore the top five, or the S&P, ignore the top five, 30% of the stocks are below 50% below their all-time highs, you know, so in the last year or so. So it's looking at the indices, it's a misnomer that really, because there's a lot of stocks struggling. And I see that as quite bullish, really, for next year, because it's a market of stocks, you know. It's not look at the indices, but there's plenty of good stocks to pick there. And I genuinely think bringing Omicron into it, that's going to have an impact on inflation a little bit. It's going to bring it down. You know, people are worried, but we've already seen that. So the Bank of England now have pushed out their expected rate hike from December the 16th to next year, probably they're saying. That's maybe going to happen. So I think it may help the markets. I think anything, we're going to go into a cracking year. Oddly, I did say on my weekly webinar and 2 weekends ago, I said, I think 2022 is going to be a bit like 2020, not as crazy as 2020, but a bit more revert to mean, where it's going to be a bit easier. You know, good stocks will do well. There's extreme crazy stuff like the meme stocks, the crypto, that will collapse, and we'll go back to a normal sort of thing. And I think past winter, post winter, hopefully it'll head towards that. I saw some of JP Morgan as well saying 2022 would be a great year for stocks again. So I'm quite bullish about 2022 because this year's been awful, absolutely dreadful, you know.
I think you're totally right. I mean, you know, again, we've sort of mentioned it a few times, but I think the last 3 months has underlined to most small and mid-cap investors that, you know, there's basically the market isn't always going up. We've had stuff which has come down, and there's lots of real opportunities, and we'll talk quite a few about them today. But just before we sort of move off on the Omicron, I know we covered it in quite a lot of detail last time, 2 weeks ago, and we both reached a sort of like a conclusion that we were fairly sort of sanguine about the sort of the medium, longer term, even if it was going to have some short-term volatility. But I don't know about you, last night when I was watching the news at about 6:30 and I saw Boris Johnson step up on his Downing Street sort of like platform and say we're going back into sort of semi-lockdown, that was a real shocker. Because, and the reason why I say that was a shocker from an investment perspective is that we've now 2 weeks into Omicron, we've had a lot of data out of South Africa. We've collected quite a lot in the UK because we've had about, I don't know, 1,000 cases or 500 cases or something like that. And I had reached a conclusion that actually, okay, it's massively transmissible. We all know that. But the symptoms are a lot less severe than certainly you and I sort of like thought on day one. And certainly the market reacted on day one. Because I think when we chatted on that Friday, the market had just gone absolutely just into a pear shape sort of stuff. But so the symptoms I'd sort of parked it were less severe and we were going to get through this no problem. So it was real sort of like eyebrow-raising stuff last night. And that says to me that the really smart scientists, and let's be clear about it, the UK's been ahead of the curve in terms of all things in medically science, in terms of vaccines and stuff like that. And this isn't precautionary. I don't think this is precautionary. I actually think this is, they are seriously worried that this thing could get out of line, i.e. such that from their 2 weeks of collecting data, and you and I can't see all the data they've collected, but they wouldn't have just taken a total run at this, in my view. So based on that level of information, they've reached a conclusion that actually there's a serious risk of getting 1,000 people in hospital in January a day. Now, that means that the efficacy of existing vaccines, the Astra and the Pfizer and probably the Moderna one, after two jabs, is quite significantly compromised, and therefore they're going to have to play catch-up with a booster, hence delaying it. I mean, I'm just really, this is a lot of my supposition, but it does worry me how the really brainy scientists who have been ahead of the curve in the UK are now saying that actually we should go into a semi-lockdown. So I actually think we will have opportunities to buy good quality stocks over the next 2 or 3 months, because we're going to see quite a bit of volatility continuing, simply because I don't think this is a storm in the teacup in the short term, but we will get through it with the boosters. It does look as though, from what Pfizer said yesterday, that after three jabs, then this good efficacy, and it will still prevent people getting out of, staying out of hospital. Then what your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you'd be proud of me. I actually got a spreadsheet together right the other day, and I thought, okay, let's look at the rate of transmission here. And I just went through it. Okay, this thing is doubling every 3 days or 1.47 or something like that. And so I went through it and put that out to the end of the year, and the numbers are staggering, but this is worst-case scenario. Now, they model on worst-case scenario, of course, pretty much. And We have to. It's hard though. And I looked at the rate of hospitalisation, which is on Delta variant, is well 1.5% of people cases. So I did that. Then I said, let's put it down to 1%, just put it over 0.5%. But even on that, on 0.5%, it's quite scary how many people will end up in hospital. But I don't think that'll happen though, because if we're looking at South Africa, 25% are vaccinated. That's all. Over here, it's 75%. First and foremost. Also, our booster program.
It's a much younger population in South Africa. Remember?
Yeah. But I mean, there are, you know, like 20 million already booster have been boosted. That's pretty much the vulnerable done. You know, at least.
Yeah. There's two things you've got to be aware of in South Africa. One, it's a much younger population. Okay, so they shouldn't be getting into hospital as much. And the actual threshold for people to get into hospital in South Africa is a damn sight higher than it is in the UK, i.e. you've really got to be in a bad place to get into a South African hospital than you have in the UK. So
Exactly. But it's flipped though. It's literally, you know, over here, 3/4 are vaccinated. Over there, only 1/4 are, you know. So that's got to have an impact. They say it does, you know. And again, Omicron, the World Health Organization is saying no one's actually died from it. And if you have some kind of, you know, vaccinations, there's very little chance of severe illness. So I don't know if even if we get big cases, I think we're focusing on the cases. It'll be interesting to see whether that translates into hospitalizations. Because
that's what I thought as well before 6 o'clock last night. It's just very surprising that these super smart scientists have taken a very sort of serious and severe line. And I can only interpret that is that they're actually quite worried, and these guys know. So,
but I don't understand that. But do you think it's a bit of politics? Because the politics don't make any sense. First of all, I think it's a bit of we're doing as much as we can kind of thing. We've been behind the curve before, but you know you've got things like you work from home but go to Christmas parties. That's fine. Wear masks in theatres and cinemas, but you don't have to wear them in restaurants and pubs. It's all over the place. I'm thinking, this won't do anything. And also, a lot of scientists are saying, once you have community, you know, transmission, there's no point shutting the borders. It's like, and I said on Twitter, it's like literally putting a raincoat on when you're going swimming. It doesn't make any difference. You know, it's here. It's going to spread very quickly. All we can do is get the booster program out there and protect the vulnerable, because most people won't have any effects from it, I don't think. But
what you've just said to me, Justin, is perfectly logical, and where I was at 5:59 last night, okay? And it just really sort of woke me up, and I was thinking, these guys are not daft. Why are they doing this? This is really out of the ordinary. And for scientists to do something like that isn't saying to me it's precautionary, because the politics are definitely saying we're not just going to put a belt and braces approach on this because it's Christmas and we've put our political reputation on it. Plus, with obviously all of that party stuff at the Downing, it would have been a really worst case scenario. So they're forced into it. I don't think they're doing this lightly, Justin.
But the policy can be totally ineffective if you're saying if pubs and restaurants are fine, you know, most places are fine, but you've got to wear them in other places.
Let's see how we pan out. All I would say is that I actually think there's some great buying opportunities at the moment, and we'll talk about those shortly. And I think we'll still have lots of good buying opportunities going forward, because I think we'll have the baby in the bathwater syndrome over the next 2 or 3 weeks while this actually works through and people get sort of like, you know, triple jabbed up. Anyway, listen,
we know if you really want a good price in the markets, you know, fear and uncertainty play into that. Research good companies. And like I said, Buffett does this all the time, doesn't he? He will sit on a tump of cash when a certain metric, is it the GDP versus the earnings of the markets? If he gets too high, he just starts selling. He'll sit on cash for as long as he wants. He knows the market will correct on some kind of fear and uncertainty, and he buys into that. That's how to get good discount prices. That's a sale in the stock market, and that's how you do it. That's how you get better than other people. You buy cheaper than the herd, you know? So if you've got your eye on a company and its shares been rising a little bit. Now it's coming back and it's going to drop a little bit more. It's an opportunity, you know, to top up, because fear and uncertainty doesn't last forever. And I think 2022 will be a good year. So, but it's contrary. People don't want to buy into fear. That's very hard. That's why investing can be hard, you know. Anyway, let's talk about, first of all, let's talk about Equals. So I had Ian Stafford Taylor on that's one stock that's doing very well out of, all a lot of AIM stuff that isn't doing well. But and the numbers, you know, the fundamentals are supporting it. Record revenue growth and all that. A good pick there from yourself there.
Well, he did seem to be quite bullish when you spoke to him yesterday, didn't he? Mm. Deservedly so, because, he's him and Richard Cooper, the CFO, have really turned that sort of ship around. And over the last 18 months, I mean, it's been through, obviously, the pandemic. It was actually in a good position before going into the pandemic, but then got absolutely hammered because of the sort of legacy consumer travel business, etc. But the acquisitions he smartly made before then into the B2B has really started now coming back as lockdown has sort of like eased off and started sort of like getting some traction towards the back end of this year. And I think it's the business now has just taken off in the second half because they've built out that bank-grade technology offering multi-currency IBAN international accounts, which has not only attracted the SME market, which is their sweet spot, but has also started attracting some of the large cap corporates as well. And they did that sort of like flagship contract, you know, 4X deal, earning them commissions £1.5 million. And that must have been an enormous transaction, showing that their in-house expertise to gain with their bank-grade technology. And if a company of that ilk and that size decides to go with Equals, that just says everything. And I think when you just do the numbers, you strip out that one-off transaction in Q4, they're still doing £1 million of revenue a week. So if you multiply that by, say, 50, next year you get £50 million of turnover. I say 50 because obviously there's a few holidays like Christmas and stuff like that, and you may have a bit of a lockdown and stuff. And I've got only 48 baked in for next year. And I see the broker, I think Canaccord, are on about that sort of number as well. And I would not be surprised if they have a bigger, because that doesn't really show much sort of like, you know, growth on the sort of week-on-week basis. I wouldn't be surprised if they do over 50 million. I mean, you know, I don't know, but this has got quite good operating, it's got very good operating leverage. What he's doing at the moment, he's making sort of so much gross margin and EBITDA margin. He's in a lovely position. He's got a strong cash position as well. And therefore, he can invest in further top-line growth. And this is going to be a very strong double-digit top-line grower for next year with increasing margins. And I know it's come a long way from sort of like 30-odd or 25p it was back last year. But frankly, it's still got a huge runway and it's trading at around about 67, 68 today, I think it is. I could see, I've got a fair value for the stock of 111, Canaccord, I think, at 99. But I actually think this could get to £1.50 within the next 2 years. So I know I mentioned it as my best stock pick at the end of last year. I'm going to probably mention it as one of my best stock picks, certainly one of my top three entering 2022, because I could see this one, you know, double again. And I know you sort of like say, well, you know, what should you do? Should you take profits and top slice and all this sort of stuff? But I really strongly believe, and this is my largest position, this is a run the winners, you know, sort of case. And the reason why I say that, because it's still cheap compared to the market, particularly cheap on an absolute terms in terms of its growth and its profit margins. But also, and more importantly than anything, the fundamentals are just fantastic behind this business. The tailwinds that is driving it and all the work that Richard and Ian have done putting this business together is really coming to fruition. So I know it's tempting to take money off the table, but unless something really untoward happens, this business is, the tailwinds are, you know, it's just absolutely flying. So run the winners.
Yeah, exactly. If it stacks up, it's not overvalued and it's improving and it's still growing, is an opportunity. Why, you know, why selling any? I mean, unless you desperately need the cash or something else, why selling any? You know, so
I mean, cool. I've got a brilliant chart which I posted. I think I did it on Vox actually yesterday, which splits out sort of quarterly sales, and I love it. I absolutely love it. And it just shows you how it, so it bottomed out in quarter two last year. So the quarter ending June 2020, turnover of about 5.8 million. Yeah? Yeah. It should do, I reckon, it should do round about just over 13 million in turnover in Q4, you know, 21. So, I mean, you know, you look at that 18 months later, it's up 150% in revenue terms, and that's a huge drop line. And it's just taken off between, I mean, just to let you know, I mean, Q1, it did 8.1 revenue. Q2, it did 8.8. Q3, I estimated it did 11.9. And it's going to, I estimate it's going to do about 13 or 13.2 for this quarter. And that's without any of the consumer-related travel stuff coming back. Which, frankly, everybody and his dog is going away next year into Europe, presumably, as we get through three jabs. So it just shows the underlying momentum, and all that growth has come from the B2B side. You know, that's all high margin, good drop through international payment stuff. So they're doing a terrific job. I've got no major worries on that stock. So I'm delighted for the company, and you know, all shareholders. So I'm going to run my winners on that one, definitely.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you saw TUI. They were saying that their summer bookings levels are back to pre-pandemic, you know, levels there. So they're bullish. And I think just generally on the variants, the more vaccinations we have, you know, the more we'll be protected against them. And again, AstraZeneca has come out again with some some medication and some of that looks like help the fight against it. So we're getting more tools. As time goes on, we're getting more tools against coronavirus.
Yeah, the AstraZeneca one is definitely interesting because that's basically a long-acting antibody cocktail that they got FDA approval yesterday for, I think, they announced it this morning, and it's called Evusfeld, I think, which got an efficacy of nearly 80%. But it can be injected like a vaccine, and therefore doesn't need intravenous. Taken intravenously like other patients, like other antibody. And that'll serve the 2% of the population who are immunocompromised or get a severe reaction to a vaccine side effects and stuff like that. So that's important because it will keep all those guys hopefully out of the hospital. And I know the US government has already ordered 700,000 doses, because they've got 7 million US citizens who are immunocompromised, i.e. whether they've got just poor immune systems themselves or they're taking drugs like immunosuppressants, like, say, kidney transplants and stuff like that. So that is important, you're right, from the AstraZeneca boys.
I don't know if it's true yet, but they're saying that the more this evolves, this virus, the less virulent it becomes. So, and of course, the more protection we have as well. So I think, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, but I think they'll become less severe and less of a problem as time goes on, to the point where, like now, I can't see, well, saying that, who knows, but last year we had a lockdown. This year it's not quite a lockdown. I mean, your face masks and stuff like that, you know, COVID passports. And then next year, hopefully, we won't have any restrictions, you know? So it'll ease off slowly like that, anyway. But
one of the beneficiaries of the sort of, we do have a sort of like a semi-lockdown, will be one of my stocks, which will be Boohoo, because they should, selling online, I mean, with shops sort of like selling less, physical shops. And these guys are sort of like, I mean, the charts are just all, the chart for Boohoo's terrible, but it is for all of the online retailers. So I would definitely say, investors, have a look through all of those online retailers, because that is real classic baby in the bathwater stuff. And I'm confident on, you know, I'm not confident, but I'm you know, I think Boohoo will be fine long term, because even if we did open up, I think it all fully open up, it's going to be absolutely fine. So
And it was, you know, the great businesses, and there's a smaller one as well that someone in the club mentioned. And I've watched the documentary of In the Style Group, very similar. They use Instagram a lot for their things, but it's a lot smaller. ITS, exactly the same chart as Boohoo, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, these are the kind of things. It'll take a bit of time, you know. But that's it. If you've got a bit of patience, it'll do well as the economy sort of starts to go again, and the sort of shipping costs come down, all that stuff happens, because, you know, that's already happening, isn't it? You know, we've hit peak costs on freight and all that stuff. So it'll take a while to come down, but it'll help, you know.
Area that people should have a good pick through in terms of sort of look over Christmas, looking through sort of like stocks of interest, is in the healthcare sector. And I mentioned to you, you know, previously with Amrit Pharma that I own, and they're delisting. And I've had a couple of questions from investors in terms of, you know, what does it mean with the delisting? They're delisting the AIM shares, but essentially converting them to ADSs. And just as a, from my understanding, this is really for sort of investors' knowledge, et cetera, you've got three types of account typically as a nominee that investors can choose. You've got an ISA, a SIP, and you've got a dealing account. For your dealing account, it should be absolutely fine. Most all the brokers I use, which is Hargreaves Lansdowne, AJ Bell, and HSBC, all of them should be absolutely fine in terms of the dealing account. With regards to the SIPs, everything should be fine as well. There's no sort of like legal requirement that you can't hold ADSs in that either. And there's no, but with the ISA, that is a slight problem because you can hold legally under HMRC rules an ADS in an ISA as long as the underlying share is still traded on a listed exchange. So the AIM share would need to be listed, and that's where it's going to fall down because it's going to be delisted. So if you own Amrit Pharma shares in an ISA, then unfortunately, like I do, you know, I own them in a dealing account, my SIP and my ISA. But if you open them in an ISA, you're going to have to basically either transfer them out or alternatively sell them or alternatively cross-trade them. Now, certain brokers will allow you to do a cross-trade, which is basically a broker-to-broker transaction off exchange where they have a pre-agreed price and they just shift the shares from one account to the next. So I wanted to transfer them from my ISA in my HSBC into my AJ Bell SIP using cash, but as the mid-market price. AJ Bell were absolutely fine to do that part of the cross trade, but I don't think they wouldn't tell me exactly why, but HSBC can't do that transaction. And the reason I think it is because they're not regulated to do an off market cross trade. So what that means, but if you don't have that issue, then you should be able to do it. That's really not a problem as long as you sort of like, you know, do it on just as a normal straight purchase, actually using cash, there should be no issue. So for me, I'm going to continue holding and convert my Amrit Pharma shares into ADS for my dealing account. I will do the same for my my SIP account, albeit with AJ Bell, they won't allow you to buy any more ADSs. They're just allowed to sell them eventually. And then with my ISA, what I'm unfortunately going to have to do, I think, and this is a problem that a lot of people are going to do, I'm just going to effectively do an in-specie transfer into my dealing account and then convert them into ADSs. So that's a bit of a pain because you take them out of a tax shelter into your own personal dealing account. So you then have to pay tax going forward, which is a bit of a pain, but frankly, I've got no choice. I definitely don't want to sell them. But I thought that was important because I've had a lot of questions from investors in terms of what to do, particularly if you hold them into an ISA. And the options, unfortunately, seem to be either to sell or to effectively move them out, and I'm having to move them out and let those into my dealing account. But that's important to know, I think.
So why have they done that? Because obviously it's going to knock the share price a bit.
They've done it basically for liquidity because most of the shareholders are out in the States. They own ADSs, and they didn't want two lines of stock degrading from the actual liquidity. It also reduces the actual, sort of like their own costs because they haven't got to do listing fees and all that kind of stuff. So, yes, it's a bit of a short-term pain, but it's one of those things. These things happen. The ADSs are reasonably liquid, but it's just unfortunate once you get these delisting that then delisting the AIM shares, it catches out on the on the ISA. If they'd have kept on, then it'd be fine. Then moving on then in our healthcare, we also had Oncommune, etc. They came out with them, and it's a bit like a game, you know, equals. They when I spoke to the CEO Adam Hill a couple of months back, he said he had a slow Q1, but had seen a strong pickup in Q2. Well, that had actually continued through, and they've had a record Q2, winning new customers and extending existing contracts and stuff like that. So they're really, you know, he's pretty positive and he thinks he's continuing into the new year. And I mentioned to investors before, this could well be a pivotal year FY22 because it's going to be the first year that they start really generating profits on turnover. I think the broker's got around about £12 million. But the operating margin and their operating leverage is really strong for this business. It sort of dropped through. So, you'll see it go from loss-making last year to profit for this year. So they're in a really good position. It's about, I think their Immuno Insights business, I think you told me, was got sort of like gross margins of 80% plus. And they're one of the only games in town for that type of immunodiagnostic sort of service, etc.
So how do you value that? For example, because like I said,
it's a really difficult one to value, and I have noticed actually Singer have given up trying to value it because they haven't even got a price target. But I would say look at what other similar businesses have gone for on the market on a takeover, and if you look at what Grail went for and Thrive went for in the US, they were sort of like four, five, six times what the platform, the R&D platform spend. And if you run those sort of like numbers using a four times multiple of what Oncommune has spent, which is about 70 million, you get a £220 million enterprise value divided by about, I think it's about 70 million shares, if I'm right. It's about £4 on a takeover basis. Shares are currently about 170. So if you look at it on a sort of like, just a normal sort of standalone, take about 30% off that. And then you on a standalone basis, you still get over £3, but on a takeover, it could well be £4. So it's a difficult one to value. It's really what somebody's prepared to pay. But essentially, the unique dynamics, the unique economics for this thing are so strong and the IPR is so rich that it's really what somebody else is prepared to pay. But when the really big boys like, Roche and Genentech and people like that can't do it in-house, they've got something really quite special there that is highly valuable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I know you've been sort of like digging through some stocks, haven't you, some sectors? You said you've got sort of like one stock you're looking at?
Yeah, so I've been talking a while, now about, when I look at companies, when I look at trends, hot mega trends are going to last for a long time, because you've got to be careful, you're swinging with the current sometimes, because sometimes if you're swimming against the current, it doesn't matter what company you got. If their fundamentals are good, and it's literally, like an oil and gas stock, you think, well, money outflow happening there, you're swimming against the current, So I've started, about a month back, investing in a company called GTEC. Now, initially, GTC is a ticker there. Initially, they were a consultancy service. They got software as a service, and they use it for geospatial and all that stuff to help companies find, and manage their assets, mineral assets, energy resources, all that stuff. But the exciting bit was this. In January, they started to acquire a company called H2 Green, which is in the green hydrogen space, which is very exciting. And it's a developer of green hydrogen hubs. And I thought, this is very interesting. And I've been reading about green hydrogen a lot. And the growth there is phenomenal, just because lots of countries now are employing strategies specifically around green hydrogen, which is, of course, hydrogen that comes from renewable power, which is solar or wind. But H2 Green, very interesting. They've already signed deals with SGN Gas Network, and that's a gas network in the north there in Scotland and London area. They're already doing a project to sort of power 100 homes off green hydrogen next year. They've also, H2 Green, have also done a deal with Evershot Railway, who've bought 10 hydrogen trains already from Alstom, which the people supply the trains in Germany. And they've also done a deal with Element 2, who are building apparently the biggest hydrogen refueling sort of port stations in the country. Now, they're just in their first kind of deal. So up until recently, they've just software as a service. But this deal with H2 Green is very interesting. They've just done a deal with Shoreham Port, and it's going to become a green energy hub. And they say this is the blueprint for further deals. They've already got about 30 sort of sites penned in with SGN Gas. So we think, okay, they could be doing this with 30 sites or more. But this deal is very interesting because the brokers come out and said it's no capital requirement. They supply their expertise, their software. They get 20% of the project. And essentially, I think about 10 tons of hydrogen per annum is roughly equivalent to 5.5 million in revenue, 2.2 of EBITDA. And this is no capital requirement. And so you think, whoa, that's nuts, isn't it? So if you look at that, they're only valued at 23 million. They've got 7 million in cash. Their existing business turns over about 4.2 million, they're saying, this year. 2.2 is in recurring revenue. But that site alone underpins that valuation. Now, if they roll this out to 5, 10, 30 sites, that's phenomenal. because you're talking about, you know, 165 million of revenue, pretty much, EBITDA. You know, this could be, you know, a mid-cap company if that blueprint is used for the rest of these projects. Now, but I'm just looking at the background of hydrogen. I've been reading it on a daily basis about news, and even since COP26, it's, you know, increased and grown even further with, you know, countries and big companies like Shell, BP, Ineos, all that, ploughing billions into green hydrogen production. And Bloomberg is saying they studied the forecast that global green hydrogen production will skyrocket at a compound annual rate of 57% between 2019 and 2030. That's from 40,000 tonnes to 5.7 million tonnes produced in that period. It's phenomenal. And if you look at it, even in this year, it's gone crazy. It said, so globally, electrolyzers, I mean, ITM are the big player, by the way, London listed. It's 2.6 billion market cap company. But electrolyzers are needed to separate, you know, the water, the hydrogen. And ITM, the big players in this space. But global capacity at the moment is only 200 megawatts. Now, Britain have a strategy to produce 5 gigawatts by 2030. So global, so 200 megawatts, let's put that in mind. By the midpoint of 2021, it's now 6.3 gigawatts. So, sorry, 200 megawatts it was in 2019. And now by this year, it's 6.3 gigawatts. And already 1.3 gigawatts announced in this quarter. And the reckoning should get to like 20, 30 gigawatts globally by 2030. So it's a very strong you know, trend I like to be in. And GTEC, for example, have got this model here. They've got the software and all that stuff, but it's very capital light and it's very scalable. And I think at the moment, they've got tons of cash compared to the market cap. You know, they're not, I think they made a loss of about a million last year, but that's growing. So I just think it's a very interesting space and it's very scalable and I quite like it. And I want to get exposure to this area because I just think it's a huge long-term trend. And I've set up a Google Alert.
What's their USP in it?
Pretty much they have, pretty much IP, their software. They've got trademark software that can, if you look at their geospatial models and everything, for example, their biggest customers pre-hydrogen were petrochemical companies, and they'd sort of do geospatial surveys for them and all that, and they'd do a mapping and use their expertise to see where they're likely to see assets, where it's worth drilling and all that stuff. So it's managing energy assets. But now they're switching to hydrogen. So they've got the expertise and the software, basically, and because of that...
This is Jonathan somewhere, isn't it? Jonathan?
Yeah, Dr. Jonathan Copus, yeah. Yeah,
okay. Yeah. So basically, they're using their seismic survey data so how are they using that for the hydrogen sector?
How to locate optimal spaces to put, you know, ports, hubs, refueling stations, because they want to do, generation, storage and production in certain areas, and they're just pinpointing where the best places are for that in the country, for optimal growth, for take-up and all that stuff. Because at the moment, the problem with hydrogen...
Which parts of the world? Because they used to have... It's basically largely in third world countries. I mean, you're saying it's actually in the UK?
UK now. Shoreham's the first deal they've announced, Shoreham Port, to create an energy hub with Ricardo. And the interesting thing is these are investment at operation level. So you get grants or local companies investing in it. It's not done through equity, you know, and they get a share of the deal. So, it's just very interesting. It's the first one. There's some details on it. I mean, there's the broken up stuff.
When are you going to post some details on that? Just because, I mean, actually what you're saying is they're lift and shifting their existing fossil fuel model into the green hydrogen space, and they believe it's highly applicable to be able to pinpoint where best to have facilities and infrastructure to be able to produce green hydrogen. That's
produce,
what you're store, saying.
Produce, store these hubs and refueling stations, of course. So produce, store, and create refueling. And this is for HGV, mainly heavy goods vehicles, trains, which is shown as, you know, it's better utilised for hydrogen rather than batteries, because batteries are too big. And of course, if you're transporting cargo...
It's the infrastructure. It's basically they're supplying the information to be able to site and locate and build the infrastructure. Not actually the physical trains, but actually the...
No, exactly. They'll be using all the knowledge and software and all that stuff to manage the projects and see best locations, you know, all that stuff, most viable locations. Because at the moment, we're still at a time where... you know, there's not a huge amount of demand, so there's no point trying to supply a huge amount. It's got to be a step increase in both. You know, it's huge investment coming in, but there's got to be a step increase in the supply that will meet the demand. You know, you're still producing lots or not having enough or producing lots of, you know, vehicles that haven't got access to supply. So it's a very, you know, clever balancing trick of where to produce, you know, how much to produce, and is it viable? And of course, the cost of green hydrogen will come down with the price of electrolyzers. Apparently, they're going to drop by. They've dropped.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you. Okay, well, post some details on, because you definitely piqued my interest there. That's for sure. If they can lift and shift that business model from essentially exploration of petrochemical resources into developing infrastructure for green hydrogen, and it's a USP against other key players in the sector, then that's a real home run, that is.
Yeah, it's very, and of course, when you, it's just so hot at the moment, hydrogen, look it up. I mean, it's now, you know, we saw EVs as being very hot previously, and companies went nuts off the back of that. I think that a lot of that is shifting, that heat is shifting towards hydrogen, because it's a lot of moving parts involved. Once you get into it and understand it, and you think, well, hang on, the money, all it needs is investment, like new technology, and the investment is coming in by the truckload, you know, absolutely, huge amounts are pouring in. There's very few countries now that don't have a green hydrogen strategy, and with that comes a lot of money, of course.
What's the share price of GTEC?
What at the moment? 35 pence, I think they are.
What was the market cap? About 20 or something?
20, 23, yeah. And they've got last announced 6.7 million in cash. So, yeah, they raised that off the back of that. So, yeah.
He's a bright guy, actually, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Was it Corpus, is it? I can't remember.
Corpus, yeah, Jonathan Corpus. Yeah,
yeah, I remember speaking to him years back, and he knows his onions, so that's a really interesting pivot, actually. But that's what
it is. I mean, if it wasn't for that pivot, I probably wouldn't be interested in the company. I mean, it's this pivot alone. I think it's very interesting. They've gone from just supplying services to actually being now an operator of, you know, these sort of hubs as well, managing the hubs as well, using their expertise. So it's very interesting and a huge growth area. And like I said, they've got plenty of cash and not losing lots of money. So, scalability.
Good man. Well, that's a great idea, that is, Justin. Appreciate that. Thanks very much. Your investors will definitely have a look at it.
Yeah, no worries. Cool.
There's a couple of others. Two, 6 months ago, I talked about a couple of fallen angels, Clinigen and Blue Prism. Well, I didn't buy in, but I should have done, because pushed the clock forward to half a year, and they've both been taken out by private equity at higher value. So I've made 40% on each one. But essentially, what that says is that when you do a sum of the parts like you've just done in GTEC and you identify this value, it doesn't take too long for some other smart people to pick up on the story and see whether they can realize value under new ownership. So both of the healthcare boys, Clinigen and Blue Prism, who are effectively robotics, both got taken out. Now, the reason why I mentioned that is because I've got two other sort of fallen angels. Now, I would caveat it, these are high risk, and I'm not 100% sure they are fallen angels. They may be falling knives, so I'm not You know, it's always difficult at this stage, at that pivot point, when it's inflection point, to decide whether it's a fallen angel, whether it's going to be a falling knife, and a bit of a sort of like. But they are definitely contrarian plays. Now, first one was really, and I tip my hat basically to my daughter's boyfriend, Tom Goff, because he came round for dinner about a month ago. And he said, Paul, I understand you do a bit of this investing lark. And I said, yeah.
A bit of it. That's all I do. I'm obsessed with it. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, I love this guy.
I've been dabbling for a few years. That's how I replied.
Did you send your daughter? I love this guy. Keep him. He's a keeper.
he said, well, I've been, you see, he's about 27. He's a qualified accountant, ACA. right guy. I think he got a first out of Duffy University or something. So he's definitely, he knows his maths and his onions. So he's my sort of man. Anyway, he says, I've been doing a bit of investing, and most of his in portfolios is the mega tax stuff. But then he said, what about, he sort of piqued me interested and said, Paul, now, what about Purple Bricks? A major nearly hit the ground. And I said, Purple Bricks, isn't that sort of an online real estate agent that's basically had a damaged brand? And I said to him, the biggest problem I had with Purple Bricks for years and years was such that they took people's money, £1,000, and they never actually had an incentive to sell, because there was no sort of guarantee that they'd actually sell and they'd get your money back. Well, he said, well, actually, just for your interest, they changed the business model of December. They've had a new management team, a new CFO, CEO. And they're basically re-energising the business, and they've pivoted it from effectively just taking a listing fee to do a money-back guarantee. So yeah, when you pay your £1,000, if they don't sell your property, they'll give you that back. But they're also, the other two big problems Purple Bricks have had, which they're solving, is one, they've always been considered a bit of a DIY type of estate agent. Well, they're actually putting a lot of services and other sort of information to be able to help buyers and sellers, etc., to get more information, to bring that localization. And they're also sort of like, they're moving all of their employees. I say they used to use effectively third-party contractors, used to give them franchise agreements, local licenses to be able to do the transactions in a particular area. Well, that wasn't really doing, you know, helping the brand, because people would just take the customer's money and then move on rather than actually sell it. So they've actually now employing people, which is great, because that's going to lift quality and make it more sort of a local type of service. But that'll take time. And that transition, that pivot, that only really started over the last 4 to 6 months. Now, the problem they've had is that they've done that pivot, that change, that restructuring at the same time as the market is for new instructions has gone bad. Because if you actually turn the clock back 18 months ago, when we all entered lockdown, we then started looking at Rightmove and Zoopla and On the Market for new houses, and people started moving out from the cities into the sticks, and all those you had a huge ramp up of transactions for 12 months, and that just took out a lot of inventory, the actual spare housing stock in the market. So there's very few. One of the reasons the house prices are doing so well is simply because there's very few houses actually to buy, because they've all been bought so far. But that will rebalance, because the biggest cure for high prices is high prices, and that will attract more sellers next year. And I think spring could be a big, reasonably good year. And that's actually what On the Market told me when I interviewed them 2 weeks ago, and there's a good video on that when I spoke.
Yeah, I watched that. Very good. Yeah, and in fact, saying that on the prices, as confirmed by the Royal Chartered Institute of Surveyors today, saying that lack of supply is keeping the house prices up there. But of course, you've also got a bit of upward move in the interest rate next year as well. So you may see, and like you say, I've seen already house prices starting to come down a little bit. People trying to get them sold, so you may see a bit more stock coming on board. What's the sell point? Purple Bricks, though, I've just been reading through the last trading update. It seems a bit negative. Maybe that's priced in, but...
Well, this is it, you see. This is what I'm saying. Is it basic? It just is ridiculously valued at the moment. I mean, it looks as an option, because the market cap's about 100 mil. They've got... The last count, they had 58 million of cash, which is about 19p per share, Let's just say they have just over 50 million of cash. So half the value is in cash. And then you say, what is the brand worth? Well, the brand Purple Bricks is pretty well known as established, across the UK. People know it just needs to be cleaned up, which is what the management team is doing. So how do you actually value Purple Bricks, as in like what the brand is worth? Well, I would say it's at least one time sales, if not probably closer to, I would say two time sales. And then they should do 90 million of sales. They did 90 million of sales last year. It'll be about 76 this year, because obviously they've had a low level of a new instruction just because of the market.
Yeah, 20,000.
But they could easily do 100 million the following year. And so let's just say they do 100 million, an extra 100 million a market cap. Then, basically that's 150 million, market cap. And I put a valuation just on that basis of round about, I did calculate it. Hang on, give me a moment. Yeah, 45p per share. But if you do two times, it gets to 70p a share. And that's on a sort of like, the share count of 310 million shares. But I did notice Citibank, who aren't stupid, who are the house broker, they've got a fair value of 75p. So I actually think this is a contrarian play at a ridiculous price. Now, I come full circle to what I said earlier on. I think this is still going to have volatility, and there'll be good entry point. If you are interested in looking at this business, then you'll have chances of buying. And another opportunity is they're coming out with their interims on Tuesday the 14th. So that's only on Tuesday.
And there's plenty of time.
Exactly. Have a good look at that. And I don't think it's going to be particularly great, simply because the outlook over winter is never good. But I could really see conditions picking up. And I think what the most sort of like, pertinent thing on this one is that you know, is the brand totally damaged and you can't claim it? Well, the market is saying, yes, it is permanently damaged, but I don't believe it is. I think you can actually, you know, change sentiment. It's got 4.6% of the market. It's biggest online, its biggest estate agent nationwide anyway at the moment. So on that basis, then it can, in my view, it can be turned around. So sentiment couldn't possibly be worse. It's a contrarian play. So I've actually picked up about a half a position in Purple Bricks. You know, I'm not saying it's not without risk, and I wouldn't say it's a high conviction, but I would say there's significant upside. And at current levels, given the cash balance and the brand worth, it's probably sort of not much downside. And I could equally see if it did go down any further, even if it stayed where it are, I think the American boys, somebody's going to take this one off. I mean, just to give you an indication, yeah, Axel Springer, who are no mugs either, basically. They're a digital, you know, advertising media business out in Europe, based out in Germany. They put in 100 million quid into Purple Bricks in 2018. At £3.60. So, you know, I mean, there is definite value in this. It just really, they have the execution and the business model was damaged, in my view. And therefore, yeah, yeah, the two guys, the CFO has come from, I think he's come from Zoopla and Prime Location. So he knows this market like the back of his hand. And the CEO was appointed a couple of years ago, I think. Just over to about 2.5 years, came from moneysupermarket.com. So he knows what he's talking about as well. And I think that what they're doing is right. You just got to be patient and let this one turn through. There is more competition. Don't get me wrong. There's more competition in the online estate agent, you know, business, because there's I think it's called Yopa, which was set up by you know, the Daily Mail and I can't remember, I think it's Savills, I think, who are also the funded. So they've started. But Purple Bricks is definitely the biggest. And overall, you know, you've got to look at the market in terms of conveyancing and just being an estate agent is the old traditional model is broken. It's expensive. Yeah. It's opaque. It's time consuming. So if you can get a solution that actually works more virtually, and we did over, you know, through the lockdown, then it's got to be good. The point is, you've just got to make sure that it's still localized, it's still customer friendly, and importantly, you know, it's incentivized them as the estate agents to actually sell this business, which is the money back guarantee. So I think the business model now is right. It comes down to, and I hate to say it, three things: management, management, management. And if they can execute, then this one's going to go a lot higher. But it's not without risk. And again, I tip my hat to my my daughter's boyfriend, Tom Goff, because he raised it. And I'd looked at it before and thought, I don't like the business model. But actually, I do like it now. And the new business model works. They do also have the other big risk they do have is a bunch of their old, you know, licensees who were selling in the territories. They're claiming that they want back pay for employment rights when they're effectively franchisees. So I can't see them winning that, but hey, they're giving it a shot. Why not? You know, they're claiming the same rights as Uber, and that's got to run out. But I actually think that's, again, another storm in a decaf.
Yeah, but it's a tricky one, isn't it? You think, is it all the bad news priced in? But looking at the share price, it could be. But I mean, just looking at the instructions last year, what, 58,000 instructions at 1,500 quid per instruction revenue, that is. So they're reckoning to do 22 in the first half of this year compared to 35 last year. So, and they're going for 20% growth. I don't know. It's like, I think, like you say, plenty of time to look at the results coming out and to pick
it's
it apart.
It's option value,
you
know. I think. It's option value in terms of, you know, what it is. Another one to have a look at, quickly,
I don't know much about it, but one of the guys in the Share Investment Club, ULS Technology, is in the e-conveyancing space. They've got a tuple of cash. Do you know about those? But if you're looking in that area,
Gresham House like it.
Yeah, they're shaking up that kind of e-conveyancing sort of area. And they've got, I think they're 47 million market. They're with 20 million of cash or something ridiculous. It's like the half their market cash. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
23 million in cash. Yeah, so
I can tell you, Purple Bricks and ULS Tech as a joint, you know, if they joined, would be a great combination because you get all the ULS Tech back office, you know, as well as obviously the front brand for Purple Bricks. It'd make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Cool. What's the next one?
Yeah, next one, which is the second fallen angel. And this is one I was sort of like, you know, highlighted in the past by Judith McKenzie at Downing, Gervais Williams at Premier Miton, and I think it's James Thorne at Columbia Threadneedle. And also, I know Simon Thompson, Investors Chronicle, likes it. I'm not sure he likes it as much now, but the shares have just totally tanked. It's Venture Life, that's ticker VLG.
Oh, yeah, I used to have these guys on the podcast a while ago. Jerry,
have you? Okay.
CEO, yeah, it was about 2 or 3 years back, but yeah, just before he started. Took off, and then the share price recently has had a bit of a tanking. But yeah,
basically, what they do is niche over-the-counter healthcare products that allow individuals to self-treat themselves. So they've got things like dental mouthwash. They've also got ladies' health stuff, and they've got about half the business is their own brands, where they're spending they're making their acquisitions. Another half business part of the business is distributing other people's brands. But this business is basically, if you think about it, over-the-counter niche products is relatively high gross margin, high for, you know, unit economics, long-term grower, sort of like, you know, double what GDP is, et cetera, as the healthcare and demographics sort of like, you know, increase, et cetera. And they should be able to do sort of like, you know, on a steady state basis, 20% EBIT margins. So this is a really good steady Eddie type of sort of like business. That they're arbitraging essentially the small and large cap in the healthcare sector, because as they get bigger, their economies of scale get greater, their margins get bigger, and their valuation, their rating increases because they become more of an attractive acquisition target. So this buy and build strategy has worked perfectly up until it didn't, which was about 6 months ago. And what seems to have happened is across the whole sector, it's been hit by two major headwinds. First and foremost is that the whole of the FMCG sector, certainly in the healthcare sector, over the counter, seeing surprisingly quite a lot of destocking actually. And I heard that from Robinson today, who does a lot of the packaging and supply. They've said they've had destocking as well. And so they've been hit by that because they sell into pharmacies and into also supermarkets on their pharmacy counters in supermarkets. And that slowed up their sales, particularly of their own branded stuff. Plus that the other headwind they've been hit is supply chain problems with extra, you know, sort of like costs for freight and also for their own raw materials. And they haven't yet been able to push the price increases through, which will be coming through next year. So I actually think this is set up for quite a good turnaround story. What was noticeable as well, when they came out with their profit warning a couple of weeks back, or last week, I think it was.
Yeah, 1st December.
Three directors all bought in. So you had the CEO, the COO, and the chief manufacturing guy all bought about, I think, £35,000 worth each of additional stock at around about 35p, which is where the shares currently trade at. Which says to me, actually, they don't believe the story's broken. The chairman is resigning. Well, not resigning. He was moving on anyway. The CFO has also moved on. So again, there's a bit of discontinuity there, and so there's definitely risk. But you have to sort of like view it. Is this a fallen angel or is this a falling knife? Well, actually, there's real value there. If you can get that, and it comes back again to the three important things, management. If they can turn around this business, and they should have some following wins next year because you'll get restocking and you will get basically an easing of the supply chain, plus they'll have the pricing power of new sales prices increases coming through, then they should do all right. And I was looking at the actual, you know, the brokers, what they've got, and I think, I can't remember what it was, I think it was 40 million of turnover they're expecting next year. Here it is, yeah, I've got it now. I think Singers have got about 40 million. 40.5 million and adjusted EBITDA of 8.1 million. So let's just say they did 8 million of, which is about right, actually, 20% EBITDA margin. It's quite a it's nice when you get it sort of like, you know, spot on. And this one should be, because it's a balanced business between its own brands and other people's brands, let's say a sort of 15 times multiple, you know, on that, then 15 times 8 is 120 mil. On 60 million, how many shares? 126 million. Yeah, 126 million shares. I mean, that's over 90p a share, you know, and your upside potential there. And even if you did 10 times, you know, 80 million, then on 126, I mean, that's what roughly around about sort of like, what, 50p or so? So, yeah, you know, you look at it, you look at a significant upside, and I did see that Singers have got a price target of 48p. So, yeah, there's definite upside. It's not without risk, don't get me wrong, but it does seem to be a fallen angel in terms of it should be their product set and their brands should be a nice, steady eddy type of defensive, high-margin business that is a premium product with good pricing power. Has all that ilk, but the shares are trading at a ridiculously low level of sort of like, hasn't got any pricing power, and it's, they're going to die its death. And I think that it does seem as though the story about destocking is correct because it's happening across the rest of the industry.
Yeah, yeah, and they've got a delay on one of their in vivo studies.
Well, I haven't got any shares in Venture Life. But,
yeah, but do you know what?
Definitely the thing is, an interesting position.
Yeah, yeah, and both those, though, Purple Bricks and Venture Life, it could go either way, like you say. But the thing is, you can just monitor it because the turnarounds take a bit longer than you think. So you keep monitoring. Mm. If it heads in the right direction, people can take positions, can't they? And that's it. You just keep an eye on the updates. You know, that's all you can do. Because one of the things I've always done, pretty much, is rush in too soon or too quickly, you know? And I've learned that. And I think even now, though, if you get something you really like, you get enthusiastic, you tend to buy it way too early, go too big, and and you know there's going to be volatility. There's always opportunity to buy more at a cheaper level. So any advice on any stock research on that, is take your time, do research, you know, because businesses often take longer to get going than you think, you know, and the share price as well.
There's some good active investors on the share register, though. So, I mean, it's like Slater Investments owns 15%. So I'm sure they'll give a bit of a sort of like, a fair win for the management to turn this one round to get it back on track. But if they don't, they'll get rid of the management. And I actually think, you know, coming back to what I said with Blue Prism and with Clinigen, they've got to be other smart people have got to be looking over both Purple Bricks and Venture Life because they're too cheap.
Universal Group, right? Which is annoying because my wife, I bought some for my wife at that company. I thought, I just got bored with it. I wanted to put something else. And literally, it rose by 25%. You went back to sort of break even, something like that. Or in fact, there's a couple of percent up. I said, on that day, a bit of liquidity, I came out of it. And then 2 weeks later, takeover, up 100% in one day. So, you know, when companies do get cheap like that, there are people waiting in the wings, watching all the time. You never know what could happen. And I've said to people in the webinar last night, I said, listen, if you're in a good company, the share price ticks down, but it's still improving, don't just sell it, you know, because you never know. I've seen companies be taken out, like I said, last 2 weeks, Universe Group gets taken out. Things like that can happen. But anyway, on its own, it can still, you know, grind higher eventually. Sometimes the market, that's the market. That's the opportunity, isn't it? Share prices don't reflect the businesses sometimes, and everything gets sold off, and that's where the bargains are. That's the market, you know?
Yeah, well, we'll have plenty more. So anyway, well, I think we've probably covered most of the stuff now. Well,
yes, more enough.
I hope you have a good holiday in the Dominican Republic, and we'll do a special Christmas edition when you come back with your Santa hat on.
Yeah, if I'm not red-listed as a country, Dominican, they'll have to quarantine somewhere. Maybe they get internet connections in the quarantine hotels. We could do it from there. But marvellous stuff. Thanks a lot, Paul, and we'll speak to you in a couple of weeks. Cheers, fella.
Look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.